Support for WKAR is provided by the Lansing Community College Foundation, supporting students struggling to afford access to education that could change their lives. More at ichange.lcc.edu. And by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet. Insured by NCUA.
Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore on WKAR. We're glad you're here. Michigan will receive $2.5 million resulting from the DocX decision. Do you remember what DocX is? This is the robo-signing scandal that Attorney General Bill Schuette filed suit over late last year, as I recall, and Michigan will receive $2.5 million in that decision. There were 1,000 cases of robo-signing in the state of Michigan, and 300 of them came from Ingham County. I think we have Register of Deeds Curtis Hertel Jr. to thank for the fact that there were 300 names as a part of that lawsuit filed by the Attorney General, but it came back in our favor, at least to the tune of $2.5 million. I'm thinking Curtis Hertel may argue that it was worth an awful lot more, but he does refer to it as a step in the right direction in this morning's Lansing State Journal treatment of the story. It is Friday. Republicans and others at the state capitol, including Governor Rick Snyder, want to reform Michigan's no-fault auto insurance system. They maintain that Michigan's law, which apparently is the only in the country to offer unlimited lifetime medical benefits, has led to excessively high rates. Here is the governor 16 days ago in his State of the State address.
We are the 10th most expensive state in the nation. In terms of no fault, in terms of claims coming in, the severity of claims, we far exceed every other state in how expensive our claims are. The average claim in Michigan is $44,000. The other next two states are $17,000 and $10,000. And that leads to high auto insurance costs for people, our citizens, our customers. And we have three of the top 10 most expensive states in the nation for auto insurance. We have Detroit at number one. We have Novi at number six, and we have Muskegon at number nine. It's time for some reforms, folks. And the two reforms I'm talking about is, first, we should reform no fault. It is time to do that in a thoughtful way.
Reformers maintain each driver should be allowed to define his or her own level of personal injury protection coverage. Again, the existing law requires unlimited lifetime medical care for car-related injuries. How does that work? Well, personal injury protection, or PIP claims in Michigan, that exceed $500,000 are reimbursed to insurance companies from payments every Michigan driver makes that are determined by the nonprofit Michigan Catastrophic Claims Association. Now, defenders of the current law, including one of our guests, maintain the latest catastrophic claims increase from last summer was politically motivated. They go on to doubt the competence of the Comprehensive Claims Association over its money management. This is one complicated issue, and here to help us understand it better, Pete Kuhnmensch of the Insurance Institute of Michigan and an insurance industry lobbyist. Hi, Pete.
Morning.
And Butch Hollowell is a spokesman for CPAN, the Coalition Protecting Auto No Fault, which opposes auto no fault reform. Good morning, Butch.
Good morning, Mark.
Please do your best, to keep your answers as simple as you can and, if possible, avoid the weeds. We want to help our listeners and this program's host understand as clearly as possible what this debate is really about. Let's focus at the beginning on the larger issue of no-fault reform. Pete Kuhnmensch, does the governor have it right? Are rates too high, and should PIP coverage not be unlimited?
Well, we agree with that generally. As you pointed out earlier, Michigan's the only state that requires a lifetime unlimited medical benefit. And with the advent of the Affordable Care Act and excuse me, the the broader exposure of health insurance for all of us, hopefully. We think it's time to have a debate on maybe that's a duplicative mandate here in Michigan. I want to emphasize we support the no-fault system here in Michigan. We think it's the right public policy for our consumers. But we've got a system that was designed 40 years ago that has a high unmatched mandate, two, very high utilization as a result of the broad benefits that are available under that. And because, quite frankly, of an anomaly in the law, we're required to pay the highest medical reimbursement rates of any other insurance category. So we'd like to address those things. And quite frankly, we think PIP choice, being able to choose that level of medical coverage, makes a lot of sense, particularly for certain categories of consumers, like our seniors who might already be covered by a full complement of Medicare benefits.
And right now, every Michigan driver pays, I gather, just over $200 a year to reimburse catastrophic claims, things like brain injuries, spinal cord injuries. Is that right?
Well, I think you're referring to the Michigan Catastrophic Claims Association, and it's not a simple answer, but the assessment on that is $175 currently per year.
$175,
and it's the insurance company that's required to pay that to the association, to the Michigan Catastrophic Claims Association.
But every Michigan driver pays $175 a year in order to cover those excessive claims due to catastrophic injuries.
Well, they pay a premium that includes that amongst a host of other costs, yes. That would be included typically in your premium that you pay for your auto insurance each year.
Butch Hollowell of CPAN, why is Michigan auto no-fault the way it is a good thing?
Well, we do agree that it is a good thing because as Governor Milliken set the statute up back in the 1972, it provides some certainty for people who have been injured, got rid of a lot of the lawsuits, and provides health care benefits to people who need them. So there's certainty that's in the system. And I think Pete and I both agree that rates are too high and reform is needed. What we disagree on is how that reform should look. And you played a clip from the governor where he said a few things such as there needs to be thoughtful reform. And you know, one thing that's a misnomer out there when he says that is that we have lifetime unlimited benefits. That isn't true. The statute says that there needs to be reasonable and necessary, quote unquote, benefits. So what that means is it might be that the companies would say, we're not going to cover this, we're not going to cover that. My dad is a doctor. Every day a company might say, I'm not going to cover that procedure or that procedure, or you might end up in court. The insurance industry has a lot of lawyers where they'll say, we're not going to pay that kind of benefit. So it's not lifetime unlimited. It's reasonable and necessary. The other thing the governor said,
Pete,
was,
let's get Pete Kumench to respond to that first.
Sure,
off.
Yeah.
Unlimited or not?
Oh, absolutely. You know, even very prominent plaintiff's attorney George Sinus, his website repeats that lifetime unlimited benefit here in the state of Michigan. Butch is right on the statutory language relative to all reasonable and necessary, but the court interpretations of that have been, and the reserves that are required to pay for these benefits are for an unlimited nature in the sense of the entire lifetime of an individual. And we're particularly talking about those with these catastrophic injuries. Without a doubt, they receive benefits throughout their entire life, both for medical services, rehabilitation services, and attendant care services, which extend as long as they're alive.
But he's got a point in that insurance companies resist some of these claims, do they not?
Well, insurance companies, under the mandate of the law, are required to pay these benefits. Now, whether or not we reimburse for an experimental treatment that maybe may not be accepted within the general medical community, things like that. But outside of that, it's a very, very generous benefit with regards to its comprehensiveness. And I think we're just simply going to disagree there, Mark.
Okay.
Yeah,
over.
Providers will say that it's not experimental. There are a lot of very basic kinds of treatments that are not covered. And, you know, the other thing that the governor said was that during the speech was that I'm a CPA. He made a point of saying that. And I wrote
that a few times.
A few times. And so I think the reason that that's important is because we've actually had to sue the MCCA so that we could get a hold of the books. We got a decision in December from a judge saying, you know, this is all public money. That's the assessment, $175 that you've talked about. But that it's been closed to the public, and we want to open up those books so that we can determine whether or not the rates that are being charged are fair. The truth is we do pay some of the highest rates in the nation. In Detroit, yes, it is the highest in the nation. And so this contributes to a lot of people driving without insurance. Across Michigan, it's almost a third who are driving without insurance. And so we have to reform the system, but not by gutting the health care benefits. There are other ways, such as prior review for rate increases, allowing refunds for overcharging, making sure that if you file a claim and you're not at fault, then they shouldn't be able to increase your rates. These are all kinds of things that should be considered.
Let's get into the machinations of the Catastrophic Claims Association. This is the nonprofit that determines this amount that all Michigan drivers pay to cover these most expensive claims, $175 a year currently, as I understand it. Your group alleges that the recent proposed increases. Did the rate not just go up recently?
It did, by 21%, which was really a disgrace because last year total assets in the MCCA, revenues were up by $1 billion and their total assets were up by $2.4 billion. And this was at the same time that they increased the assessment on Michigan consumers by 21%. So the numbers just don't add up.
You allege they're politically motivated?
Yeah, we think that they did that so that they could move legislation along that would be more in their favor. And we want to be able to look at the books and so that we can determine it's all our money. It's taxpayer money. Those assessments come out of the pocketbooks of Michiganians who have to drive. And so we want to look at what their rate-making data is. What are their loss development factors, you know, the patterns? What are the trend factors, the years associated with frequency and severity? What are the expense allocations?
Okay, we got that. Let's be absolutely clear about what you're saying, though. You are alleging that the Catastrophic Claims Association is unjustifiably hiking these payments to give the governor and other reformers an opening to justify reform?
Yes, we believe that very strongly because...
Okay. You made your point. Pete Kunmensch?
Well, the bottom line is we disagree with Judge Kennedy's decision, obviously, and claiming that this should be open to the Freedom of Information Act, and that's the tenets of what the case involves. And quite frankly, 90% of what he required to be disclosed under this court case is already available. But let me point out a couple factors. One, this is not a public body. In fact, it's clear in state statute that it's not a state agency, and that's language out of the statute, and it's not state money. Again, the MCCA is a reinsurance mechanism. The contract for your insurance is between you and your insurance company. The MCCA was actually created five years after the enactment of No Fault, and its design was to protect the solvency of small insurance companies, Mark, not to pay benefits directly. That's an obligation of the insurance company. Whether the MCCA exists or not, the insurers must pay those benefits. The MCCA was designed to protect the solvency of many of our small domestic insurers because what happened back in 1978, 5 years after the enactment of No Fault, many of these small companies realized that these unlimited claims put their companies at risk. And the legislature recognized that and stepped in and developed this reinsurance mechanism called the Michigan Catastrophic Claims Association. And that obligation to pay that benefit exists whether or not the MCCA is in operation or not. And the liability to pay that benefit rests solely with the companies. The state has absolutely no skin in this game. Now, with regard to the judgment from Judge Kennedy, we really think he's got it wrong. As I said earlier, 9 out of the 10 elements of his disclosure is already open to the public through their website. I'd encourage him to go to the Michigan Catastrophic Claims website at www.michigancatastrophic.com and look at it.
90% of this data is already available, Butch?
Totally untrue. And if anybody goes to that website and they look at it, what they'll find is disclosed is financial data. That is data that these are the assets that we have and this is the money that we've paid out. That has nothing to do with rate-making data, which is the crucial thing in terms of how rates are set. So, for example, it's kind of like voodoo, what a lot of actuaries do, but we want to know what that voodoo is. That is, what are the patterns that they look at in terms of the payouts? And what is the frequency of these kinds of claims? And what contingencies have they loaded in there? And what years did they look at? Did they look at all, last 10 years, or just did they cherry pick these 3 years? None of that. is disclosed. That is the critical information. And let me just say something else. In the MCCA, the numbers do not add up. In addition to what I said before about revenues being up, you also have a major reduction in Michigan in terms of the number of serious accidents. It's unexplainable, and it's because it's taxpayer money, we deserve to be able to have the books opened so we can examine it independently.
Again, Mark, it is not taxpayers' money. Again, the structure is such that the state is not on, it's part of your premium. The MCCA charge is one of dozens of factors that affect the price of your annual premium. What is important is that the claims are paid on time directly by the insurance companies, and individual insurance companies are then reimbursed by the MCCA after the fact. So it doesn't really have specific impact on the recipient of your benefits.
Drivers taxpayers, though?
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah, of course they are.
Absolutely.
But you're claiming they're not. It's not taxpayers' money. It's if it's drivers' money, it's taxpayers' money. Pretty much the same, aren't they?
It's a forced reinsurance mechanism to help protect the solvency of insurance companies. Whether or not it exists or not, you're going to pay a premium for that benefit that we have here in Michigan, that unlimited benefit. If the MCCA didn't exist, insurers would have to purchase private reinsurance. At the time, back in 1978, it wasn't available.
Okay.
So, to the extent that, we can argue about whether or not, in fact, it is private money, the reality is, the last time the public injected themselves in this thing, the MCCA, they were kind of backed into a corner and forced to rebate $1.2 billion to the ratepayers. That was great because at the time they had a surplus. Now the fund faces over a $2 billion deficit. It would have been great to have that money now.
We've got to wrap up. We're out of time. We should have scheduled a half an hour for this. We really appreciate both of you coming in. Butch Hollowell of CPAN, Pete Kuhnmensch of the Insurance Institute of Michigan. Many thanks.
Thank you. It is taxpayer money.
2013 brings the 100th anniversary of one of Michigan's most storied music venues, the University of Michigan's Hill Auditorium. The classic Albert Kahn-designed 3,500-seat concert hall is noted for its splendid acoustics and is the setting for countless performances by legendary artists around the globe. Now, starting at 10 o'clock tomorrow, the University of Michigan hosts its Hill Auditorium celebration, including architectural and historic tours of the venue, a presentation on Hill's unique acoustical qualities, and panel discussion, the past, present, and future of the Great Concert Hall. Another of tomorrow's highlights is the 2 p.m. premiere of the new documentary film, A Space for Music, A Seat for Everyone, 100 Years of UMS Performances in Hill Auditorium. Along with the concert series from the University of Michigan School of Music, Theater, and Dance and other presenters, the University Musical Society has been presenting Ann Arbor concerts for more than a century. WKAR's Peter Wharf visited Hill Auditorium earlier this week for a number of conversations with Hill Auditorium and UMS staff. Peter spoke with U of M music student Charlie Reichel, who is also with the UMS Education Department. Reichel recalled some of the great performers from Hill's history and his own association with the hall.
For me, Hill Auditorium is kind of home base. It's my home court for playing in the orchestra. The first time I played on Hill Auditorium stage was as a seventh grader at Clegg Middle School during one of the Ann Arbor Public Schools orchestra nights. I remember looking up and just being amazed and completely distracted throughout the entire rehearsal. I think my conductor even yelled at me to get back into the game because I was watching the curve of the parabola of the stage and the optical illusions of it, or from the stage looking up as a tiny seventh grader holding my giant string bass was too much for me. But since then, I've played in it in high school orchestras and the University of Michigan Youth Orchestra, and now as a current junior in the School of Music as a double bass performance major. I play with the University Philharmonic Orchestra, and that is truly a wonderful experience. The stage has wonderful precision. As you know, I sit in the back because I'm a double bass player, but I can hear the back of the first violins just as clearly as I can hear the people standing right next to me. And it also has a wonderful ring to those giant striking rum chords. It has this perfectly timed, not overly cluttered, but a well-rounded ring to the end of pieces. And that's one of the most satisfying pieces of playing here, is finishing the song and hearing just a very solid and consistent decrescendo of the last note, and then before the first clap happens, that last little moment where it's completely silent in the hall.
Charlie, can you touch on landmark performances?
Well, the Hill Auditorium is certainly a space that you could name almost any artist, and they played here. Rachmaninoff has come through. The Philadelphia Orchestra with Eugene Ormandy had over a 60-year span when they were playing here every year. Maybe not always with Eugene Ormandy talking about that, but right. They had a long tradition of playing in the May Festival, right. Which was a 101-year-old tradition UMS put on, a four-day classical music festival every May. Just recently, some people might remember Yo-Yo Ma performing with the Silk Road Ensemble several times in the past 10 years. The Berlin Philharmonic was here just a few years ago on one of two stops they made in the United States, New York City and Ann Arbor. Aaron Copland has played here. Leonard Bernstein has been here with the New York Philharmonic. One of the most interesting concerts that Charles Sink was responsible for was bringing Caruso, the famous tenor, to Ann Arbor. At the time, he was the world's most famous tenor, and the money that was required to bring a man like that to Ann Arbor was out of UMS's reach. But he didn't take no for an answer, and he decided to sell pre-sale tickets in Ann Arbor and raise the money, and then went back to the booking agent for Caruso and said, "Look, we're ready to do it. Bring him here."
Even before the date was booked and even before Caruso agreed to coming to Michigan, the tickets were sold.
That's right, yeah. They had fundraised the money ahead of time, even before he was booked. And Charles Sink went to New York. He said, "Let me talk to Caruso." His booking agent said, "I don't think he's going to come to a little town in Michigan. You know, he's the world's most famous tenor." Charles Sink, you know, did the face-to-face time with him. He shook his hand and said, "I'll raise the money to bring him here. Just let me know." And Caruso walked out of the room with him and said, "Yep. We're going to Ann Arbor if they can get the money," and they did.
Shades of Kickstarter 100 years before.
Exactly, yeah, really. I mean, it is about just asking people if that's something they would like. The names in the classical music world are just no way to put them all in one list. I've really just picked up on this in the past year. Looking around through the documents, doing all this research, I've found so many pictures with signatures from the artists that I study in the music school, and it's so inspirational to think, wow, I'm really playing on the same stage that Aaron Copland, Leonard Bernstein, Rachmaninoff, Yo-Yo Ma, these names are just like ingrained. Their feet have touched the same floor. We use the same bathrooms backstage. It's a very strange thing to think about, that these wonderful, famous musicians have actually come to my hometown.
Charlie Reichel at Hill Auditorium as we celebrate 100 years of great music in Ann Arbor at Hill Auditorium. Charlie, thanks so much.
Absolutely, thank you.
For Current State, this is Peter Ward.
And coming up on Current State, a play about Lansing's historic neighborhood, Urbandale. That's on the city's east side in the floodplain. That's in the second half of Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. You're listening to WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by Douglas J. with two Lansing area salon locations, the Okemos Salon and Spa and the East Lansing Salon inside the East Lansing Marriott, now offering gift cards for Valentine's Day. DouglasJ.com. And by Liberty Coin Service, now open with a new location in Frandor, offering gold buying and coin collecting services in one combined location for more than 40 years. LibertyCoinService.com.
Current state here on WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. For 3 days at least now, I have been wanting to get a plug-in for our television station and a program that I caught, I think it was Tuesday night. American Experience is a series you're probably familiar with. It's been on PBS affiliates for a long, long time, but you have to see the Henry Ford story. And I know what you're thinking. You're probably thinking, I learned everything I need to know about Henry Ford before I was 15 years old, right? You've been to Greenfield Village. You've done all of that stuff. This treatment is so fantastic. Visually, that series is just about incomparable. The way they treat photography, just the visual impact of the show alone is so powerful. Henry Ford was a titan, but a significantly flawed man, which you probably also learned when you were 15 years old. This puts it all out there. I was just mesmerized. And I'll admit to being a little biased because I love the story of how Detroit became the Motor City. I love that. I love that story. I can't get enough of it. I love going to Detroit. I love Detroit, and I grew up in Ovid, for crying out loud. But I was just mesmerized. It was 45 minutes that I saw the show, and it felt like five. I mean, I did not recognize members of my family afterwards. I mean, I was that blown away by it. But it's coming up again on WKAR real soon. American Experience, Henry Ford. Students and faculty in the Residential College of Arts and Humanities have written a play about Lansing's historic Urbandale neighborhood. The play, titled Urbandale, A Place, A People, A Story, is a year in the making, and today on Current State, we welcome Assistant Professor at MSU's Residential College of Arts and Humanities, Laura DeLind. DeLind started the project by collecting stories about the Urbandale neighborhood, and we also have Residential College of Arts and Humanities Professor Anita Skeen and MSU Senior Julia Kramer, who were involved in the play's writing process. Welcome one and all. Nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What is the play about? Tell us how this project got started, Laura.
Oh, my involvement with Urbandale goes back about 4 years with my work with Urbandale Farm. And at that point, we began to interact with the residents and see sort of the rhythm of the neighborhood. And I began really liking that place. And when we had markets, people would come and say, you know, I remember living here, or I lived in that house, or my father planted that tree, or my grandfather built that house. And I realized that all these empty spaces that we thought we could garden in weren't empty after all. They had stories in them. They had memories, and that people were very fond of this neighborhood. And so I felt that it was our responsibility, if we were going to be there and work there, to collect these stories and give them public visibility. Use them as a way to showcase this very interesting neighborhood.
Describe where Urbandale is, because I get the impression maybe the name might have been more common in more common usage decades ago, maybe more so than it is in 2013. Am I right about that or not?
I'm not sure. Some people seem to know the name, and some people have not, who live there, have never heard of it.
It goes back about 100 years,
it does,
though, right?
The neighborhood, the first subdivisions were over 100 years ago. They began over 100 years ago. And Urbandale is sort of defined, or at least the very heart of Urbandale, by 127, 496, Clemens, and Kalamazoo. So it's that little quadrant. It's almost a cul-de-sac. And it's a quiet place. It's ironically has a rural presence to it, appearance, because It has lots of mature trees. It has green spaces. It has some unpaved roads. It's quiet and very bikeable and very walkable. It has a great diversity of population. It was one of the first blue-collar subdivisions in Lansing.
Mm-hmm. And it's between Michigan and 496, basically. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Michigan? Yeah, yeah. What did students do in the course of creating this play, and what were some of the challenges that they faced in writing the play? Who wants to take that?
Well,
Anita Skeen.
Laura's class a year ago, her civic engagement course, collected interviews from about 20 people, residents of Urbandale, and Laura collected a number of those too, and I think had some help from some other people. So we had these oral histories from a group of people who had, some of them lived there a long time, some of them just, you know, the mailman or whatever. And so we taught a creative workshop, Laura and I together, in RCH 291 this fall. And we wanted to focus on the cultural meanings of storytelling and how we tell stories and why we tell stories and the fact that everyone has a story, but the stories may not be the same. They aren't necessarily right or wrong. It's a matter of perspective.
Also, the responsibility that we take upon ourselves when we try and represent someone else's story. There are ethical issues here, too, and need to be fair and honest and authentic in the voices we present.
Julia Kramer, tell us about your experience here with the play.
Well, when I saw the description of the class over a year ago, I immediately knew that I had to be in it, and I kind of weaseled my way in because I wasn't allowed to take any more creative options in the RCH, and I sort of forced my way into the class because I was so excited about the content.
You look kind of shifty the minute I laid eyes on you. So I'm really not surprised to hear that.
I was so excited about it, and it was really a unique process. I had never had a class where we really had such a concrete output at the end that we can now we're hoping to take to other places. And
a creation. You created
an actual creation. Yeah. It was really fun to collaborate with other students and collaborate with the professors and with other people outside, such as Paul, who's the director of the show. It was just a really fun and unique experience.
Who are some of the characters in the play then that took shape, and what are the issues or struggles that they contend with?
Anybody? Well, we have real people, but we have some abstractions who come to life too. The three very interesting characters in the play, I think, are House, River, and Garden.
I'm flashing on Spoon River Anthology.
Well, perhaps
we did
a little
too.
Bit.
We did too.
We did too.
In our minds.
The other characters in the play do not see House, River, and Garden, but they talk to each other and wander around throughout the whole play and kind of discuss what's going on. But they're invisible to the cast of characters on the stage, but not to the audience. And then the other characters in the play represent types of neighbors you would have, the crabby neighbor, the kind neighbor, the kids in the neighborhood, the resident who's lived there a long time and has lost his wife and doesn't know if he should stay or if he should leave. So we tried to take types and individualize them also. The characters are all composites of the oral history information we got from people. So no one hopefully will be recognizable, but yet everyone will be recognizable.
But River, House, and Garden are voices that appear. Is that it? Or are actors portraying River, House?
They're actors.
They're actors.
They're there.
They are actors, yes.
Well, you've got a segment prepared from the play, Urbandale. Can you set this up for us and perform it?
It is House, River, and Garden.
Oh, it is.
It is.
How clever of you to lead it.
No wonder we ended up with three guests.
We might want to preface this by saying Urbandale lies in the city's 100-year floodplain. It's in the heart of that floodplain. And the floods have been periodic and very devastating to this neighborhood. And it's part of the reason it is in decline, and there are so many empty houses and open spaces. So that River is a force to be reckoned with, as well as any other economic issue or social issue.
Well, if you have your scripts before you, why don't we move into House, River, and Garden mode here? Are you ready to go?
Yes, and I'll start as River.
Okay. House, River, and Garden. This is from the play about the Lansing neighborhood, Urbandale.
Howdy, folks. Hello. Hello, you all.
What are you doing here, River?
Looking around, seeing what's changed on the street since the last time I was here. House, are you ill?
He's feeling poorly today. Bad case of broken window. But that's not all. I think he needs counseling. He's going downhill.
Stuff it, Garden. River's talking to me. You've been pretty quiet these last few years. What brings you up from the muddy banks?
Hey, River, while you're here, how about flowing over this way? And put a little water on my tomatoes. It's been dry this summer. A little visit wouldn't hurt.
Nope, none of that. You can't get to garden unless you go through my yard. And once you get in the yard, you know what happens. You just keep coming. Gotta look in the basement windows. Gotta climb up the wall.
I'm just curious. I'm an artist.
An artist?
That's right, an artist. An environmental sculptor. I like to change things. I make collages out of stuff left out in yards. Abandoned stuff nobody wants. I just rearrange it. I get a lot of press. Photographers love my stuff. I get in the newspapers. I've even been in art galleries.
Well, photographers shoot me, too. But that doesn't mean I'm an artiste. If you're a sculptor, well, then I'm a poet. How about this? I have lines of chard, stanzas of broccoli. I'm full of alliteration. Potatoes and peppers and peas, plumpness of pumpkins, purple...
So what am I, a lump of coal? I'm an artifact. I have history. I have memory. I've got China kittens on the shelf over the mantel. I've got Richardson family photos in the attic. I've got somebody's shoes, about 10 pairs of them, size 8.5, in a box in the basement. I've got a quilt it took someone a long time to make, stuffed into a hole in the small upstairs bedroom. I've got...
Okay, so maybe you're a collage, too. Want to get rid of some of that stuff? Want me to take it away?
River, leave him alone. You're being a bully, you know? Can't you go back to being useful? Float some canoes down toward Portland. Don't you have any hydroelectric power to burn off?
It's okay, Garden. I know she gets restless. It's just hard to stay in one place all the time, to see stuff going on around you, and here you are, stuck to the ground for 100 years. I wish I could flow around like River through the neighborhood. I could check in on all my friends. We used to do so much more together.
Now you've done it, River. He'll drop a couple more shutters and lose a few shingles. We gotta get him back on his feet. We gotta feed him some spinach.
That's not my job, Garden. Go for it, though. I'm going back to watch the traffic for a while. You know, there used to be fish. They were more interesting than the cars.
House, look over here. How about a salad? Greens are good for you. You've been blue too long.
It's not as simple as that. There's more to the story.
Well done. House, River, and Garden from the play Urbandale. Who's responsible for composing those lines? How many people played a role in composing
those lines? Well, we had 8 students in the course, the 2 faculty members. The director, Paul Bourne, helped. And we brought in the director of Boston Playwrights Theater, Kate Snodgrass from Boston, who came for 4 days to help us. And
we were able to do that because we had written a grant to the Michigan Humanities Council. And they have provided us with funds to really get support, artistic support for this project.
I think it would be very hard now to look at lines and identify specifically who wrote them, because everyone's written and rewritten and someone else has rewritten and they've been changed. So the marvelous thing about this is the collaborative nature of it. It's not 1, 2, 3 people. It's everybody.
Are people who are living descendants of some of the real people that you have included in the play going to see the play? Is that how this is unfolding?
We've invited everybody who's been a storyteller, specifically for this project, to the play, and we've flyered every house in Urbandale and invited them to come. We're going to perform it twice tonight at 7 in the RCH Theater, but on February 8th at 6:30 in the community at Foster Community Center.
fascinating experience, and it's very interesting. I became familiar with Urbandale because Laura was in a story that I did about the organic farm down there. Lansing's first urban farm is going on right now in Urbandale, and you played a role in that, getting that launched just a couple of years ago. We want to thank Laura DeLind, assistant professor at MSU's Residential College of Arts and Humanities. Also, Anita Skeen, who's a professor in the same college, and Julia Kramer is a senior who was involved in the play's writing process. Good luck with Urbandale.
Thanks for joining us.
Paul Barnes is professor of piano at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln School of Music. He's appeared in many concerts throughout the U.S., Europe, the Mideast, and the Far East. Barnes is especially well-known for his performances of contemporary music for the keyboard. Now, tonight at 8 o'clock, Paul performs at MSU's Cook Recital Hall in a program of 21st century compositions with an emphasis on the music of Philip Glass and other composers of our time. Paul joins us now in the WKAR Current State Studio. Welcome.
Great to be here.
You will present a program devoted to contemporary music with a focus on Philip Glass. Where did your interest in Glass's music begin, and why do you consider yourself a proponent of it?
Sure. Well, Philip and I met by accident while I was doing a job interview at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He was on the flight, you know, when I was flying back, and we met. I introduced myself, and he gave me the piece that you just played, the transcription to Satyagraha, and I played it on the recital that I did in New York the following season, and he invited me over to his house, and we talked about other things that I could transcribe. In short, I ended up transcribing 11 works, which his recording label recorded, and then ended up commissioning the second piano concerto, you know, which was a wonderful project that was all supported by funds that I raised at the University of Nebraska. And I had always been excited about the aesthetic stance of minimalism because it was such a great contrast to a lot of the other music that I played. And that will be very evident in the program that I'm playing tonight in terms of the different kinds of music.
This was a chance encounter with Philip Glass?
It was a chance encounter, and so we have collaborated since that chance encounter over the last 17 years. And the culmination really was the commissioning of the second piano concerto. I'll be playing the third movement, my solo transcription of the third movement of that concerto tonight at the recital.
What is it about minimalism that resonates with you? I mean, what draws you to that?
Well, I think what it does is it gives the listener a break from a narrative approach to music where music is kind of telling a story. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And when you encounter music that's simply a process that you enter into, and it creates a very, very different and refreshing look at musical time. And I think that can be very illuminating to people for the first time.
Was Glass on your radar?
Oh yeah, definitely.
I ran into him on an airplane.
In college, we had our mandatory Koyaanis Katsi parties, and oh, were they fun parties? Very fun times. And so I was aware of what he was trying to accomplish in his music, but I wasn't aware of how much fun it would be to actually play it on the piano. And I actually do a whole lecture on the pedagogical import of minimalism and how it can really help students focus on important things in piano music, like focusing purely on musical sound. You know, when you're not constantly shaping a harmonic progression or worried about this theme or that theme, it opens up other very, very important aspects in terms of how you hear, especially sound, pure sound. I studied with Menachem Pressler at Indiana University, and that man taught me how to create beautiful tone on the piano. It was a joy. And so I've transferred that into Philip's music and, of course, everything I play.
Is minimalism an opportunity then to free yourself from a preoccupation with technique? Is that part of what you're saying?
Although there is a very specific technique that you do have to use, you know. For some of the real fast repetitive pieces, it does create the need for real intense concentration.
Focus, okay.
You know, and focus and making sure you're getting the repetitions properly and things like that. So I'm actually working my tail off to make sure that I'm creating this rather hypnotic, you know, environment for my audience. So
the obligatory Koyaanisqatsi party. You've got to tell us more about this. What happened at these obligatory Koyaanisqatsi or Powakatsi parties?
Well, mine happened at, you know, on the campus of Indiana University, and this was the first time I'd heard Philip's music. And a crazy friend of mine, who now is a composer in Seattle, John Muleisen, invited me over and said, listen, you've got to watch this and you've got to hear this, you know. And I won't say anything more about the details, except that it was really fun. And that's when I first, you know, kind of discovered the power of minimalism, especially when it was, you know, associated with such a remarkable film as well. And so I found the connection between Philip's music and film scores, and of course, which is why, you know, all of the transcriptions that I did are theater pieces. And so there is a connection, you know, with a lot of the theater works.
We share something in common here, because Powakatsi and Koyaanisqatsi absolutely mesmerized me when I first heard them. I was familiar with Einstein on the Beach before but nothing grabbed me. And I think it was the movie, to be perfectly candid with you. Those were such extraordinary experiences. In fact, we ended up seeing the music. We saw the ensemble do the music twice live. I saw it in Ann Arbor.
Great.
I saw it in Ann Arbor.
Yep.
And we were in Britain not too long thereafter, and it was in London. And I said, I got to go see this again.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just that good.
Great. Let's
listen to you, though, Paul Barnes.
Okay.
Paul Barnes performing For Alina by Arvo Pärt. That's pianist Paul Barnes, who performs tonight at MSU's Cook Recital Hall. Tell us more about For Alina.
Sure. That was a work by Arvo Pärt, who has been described as a mystical minimalist. What's interesting is I also have this in second life as a Greek Orthodox chanter. And so I remember having this fascinating conversation with Philip Glass in a cab in New York about the relationship between Buddhist chant and Greek Orthodox chant, you know, all of which is based on this wonderful harmonic drone. And that particular work I love to start off recitals with. It is clearly based, you know, on a Byzantine model, and Arvo Pärt is Russian Orthodox. And so it's based on that same idea of harmonic stasis, and then he simply harmonizes the melody with whatever next nearest note to a triad happens to be. So it's all B minor from beginning to end. So no harmonic motion except one moment in the piece. And so that one moment where it moves is unbelievably important. So it's like all of these basic harmonic motions are magnified, you know, so that their meaning becomes really apparent.
Paul Barnes is professor of piano at the University of Nebraska Lincoln School of Music. Tonight at 8 o'clock, Paul performs at MSU's Cook Recital Hall in a program of 21st century compositions with an emphasis on the music of Philip Glass and other composers of our time. Paul Barnes, a pleasure to meet you.
My pleasure.
Coming up on Monday's Current State, Super Bowl, the Super Bowl's best commercials from a couple of guys who really launched this ad mania, MSU's Bob Colt and former MSU advertising prof Bruce Vandenberg. That's always fun. These guys have made the New York Times and USA Today this year with all this ad mania about the Super Bowl commercials. That's Monday on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Joel Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks to Aaron Young for engineering. Bill Richards, Kim Geiger, Gary Reed, and Katie Wolf, many thanks for all that you do. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by Fluke Hearing, finding ways to help people hear like nature intended, with 16 locations including Lansing, Jackson, Grand Rapids, and Ann Arbor. FlukeHearing.com.